Oh, you're listening to Left Out on WRCT 88.3 FM. Left Out is a public affairs program that discusses the news from a perspective left out of the mainstream media. I'm Bob Harper.
I'm Danny Slater.
And today's program is ably produced by Alberto Guzman. Listeners are welcome to call us at 412-268-9728 anytime during the program, or to send electronic mail to bob@leftout.info, which we'll be monitoring during the show. Couple of announcements.
Just a reminder to listen to Democracy Now! Every morning on WRCT at 8 o'clock. That's a great show, with an alternative bent, hosted by Amy Goodman. Also, our co-host, Bob Harper, will be on WQED's off-cue program on April 22nd. That's this Friday.
That's this Friday.
Yeah, he's been on the show a couple of times before. It's always a blast to watch him on TV and come up against some of the arch conservatives in the city of Pittsburgh.
I always enjoy it. That airs on WQED TV on Friday night, Saturday morning, and Sunday afternoon, or something like that.
Yeah,
I don't have the exact times at hand, and I hope many of our listeners will tune in. All right. Well, we have a guest on today's program. Our guest is Dr. Christian Weller, who is a senior economist from the Center for American Progress. Many of you may have known over the last year or so, we've often cited articles that appear on Center for American Progress. It's a think tank in Washington devoted to investigating issues from a progressive perspective. And what we'd like to do today on reality-based radio is to talk a bit with Dr. Weller about some economic issues facing the nation. Christian Weller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, glad to have you on Left Out. So what we wanted to discuss with you today there's so many things, I don't even know where to begin. Maybe you might have something you might like to start with about the state of the U.S. economy and the economic policies that have been actively being put into place, especially over the last 5 years, and their effects. So I wonder if you might have a few words to say to begin our discussion.
Sure. I think when you look at the economy, what I think strikes most people who follow the discussion is how much of economic growth is dependent on debt, on deficits. We have massive deficits on the government side, and I'll talk a little bit about that. We have changed over a four-year period from 2% surplus, 2% relative to gross domestic product surplus, to 4% deficits. At the same time, we also have massive trade deficits that have devastated the manufacturing sector. And at the same time, we have private households go into debt to just make ends meet. And what does that have to do with policies? Well, part of it is that this government has taken the surpluses we had in 2000 and has squandered them largely on tax cuts, with the justification saying, like, we're going to create all these new jobs with the tax cuts. And those jobs have never materialized, and most economists weren't surprised by the fact, because when we say we want to have an economic stimulus as an economist, what we mean is we want to take money from the government, put it into the economy in a very effective way, very quickly, put it where it makes the most sense, and typically that means we want to make sure the money gets spent very quickly. And exactly the opposite happened with the tax cuts. The government took the money and gave it to the people who are most likely or least likely to spend it, or most likely to save it. So what you get is, you don't get a bang for the buck, you get a whimper for the buck, and that's what we see. We have seen some growth, but it hasn't really translated into real employment growth, and has left the government with massive deficits that are growing year after year after year. And the problem is, as I said, on the household side, because we're not creating jobs, because wages are not rising. In fact, for the last 14 months, they have fallen behind inflation. Households have to borrow money. They don't save money, so they cannot finance the government deficit. And so the government then turns to foreigners, borrows money overseas. It goes to particularly the Chinese, the Japanese, and the Korean central banks, and borrows money from them to finance the deficits. What that means is money is coming from overseas to the U.S. That drives up the U.S. dollar, which means our exports, in particular our manufactured goods, very expensive on foreign markets, and it destroys our manufacturing sector, and it helps us create a trade deficit. So all of these things are linked together. Because we have an ill-advised fiscal policies that didn't address the economic problems that we had in 2000, 2001,
well, great.
We are now left with a massive trade deficit, a massive debt for the households.
So that touches on lots of topics that I wanted to expand on. So let's go with the first one, which was the first order of business when George Bush took office was to put forward a tax cut primarily aimed at the wealthy. And I wondered if you could. I wanted to ask you about two different things. One is the nature of that cut, and the other is the effects that we're seeing today. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the facts about the economy, what we're seeing in the headlines, for example, recently is the sluggishness or skittishness in the stock market, which is only one kind of indicator of the health of the economy, but there are lots of others. So I wondered if you can tell us how we're actually doing, given that the part of the sales job for the tax cut was that it would stimulate the economy and produce new jobs and so forth and so on.
We're not doing that well. Yes, we have. I mean, when the tax cuts were enacted in 2001, the first tax cuts, there was another in 2002, another one in 2003.
Right.
The largest one was, however, the one in 2001. It was a $1.3 trillion tax cut over the first 10 years. Most of the money wasn't coming online in 2001 when the economy really needed the money. In fact, only $40 billion came into the economy in 2001 when the economy was in a recession. So the vast majority of the tax cuts came later. The vast majority of the tax cuts went to the top 1%. So there was really, it was an ill-designed, I mean, if you had to design what an optimal stimulus package would look like, this tax cut would be exactly the opposite. It was backloaded, meaning like a lot of the tax cuts would happen after the economy had hopefully come out of its problems, and it was going to people who were more likely to save the money than spend it. But what does that mean now?
Right.
The tax cuts they're permanent, where the president wants to make them permanent. But and most people assume that they will in some form or another become permanent, which it means is like the government has these massive deficits that we have to finance by borrowing money overseas, which means we as a debtor nation are facing higher interest rates. And if you look around, people are in debt. And if we pay higher interest rates, that will mean more money coming out of people's pockets, less money to spend at the supermarket or at the retail, at the groceries, at the mall. And that means like less money to go around in terms of economic growth.
So that's
probably the biggest risk for us at this point.
Okay, so when those tax cuts were proposed 4 years ago and then going forward 3 and 2 years ago, there was, you know, claims made that about how they would stimulate the economy and create growth. So we're now in a situation to evaluate how well those policies have actually worked in reality rather than in the theoretical, in any kind of theoretical framework, no matter which point of view you're coming from.
That's correct.
So what can we say today about the nature of the state of the economy and how it compares to 4 years ago or 5 years ago?
Well, very simple. I mean, the president promised millions of new jobs, and over the last 4 years, we created a total of 415,000 new jobs. That's 100,000 new jobs per year. You got to remember, just in order to keep pace with population growth, we need 150,000 new jobs every single month. So we're far behind in terms of the labor market, in terms of job creation. That also means that unemployment rates remain high for particular groups, particular minorities. The other part also means that wage growth is very weak. For the past 14 months, wage growth has actually been negative after inflation. That's pretty bad news for people who are facing higher bills for gasoline prices, for healthcare, for education, and so on and so forth. So while we have had some growth, it hasn't really materialized in any form of rising living standards for America's middle class.
I want to chime in here with a comment. There's a part of the Center for American Progress website that I found the other day. It's a recent post on your website. It's a list of the economic indicators comparing now to, I think, January 2001. So it's 4 years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's a list of about 30 or 40 indicators, and with a little thumbs up or thumbs down next to it, depending on whether it went a good way or went a bad way. And it's almost all thumbs down. I mean, are you familiar with the page I'm talking about?
Yes, I am familiar with it because I helped to create some of the numbers.
Yeah.
By and large, all indicators that matter for people are typically down. The employment creation is weak. Wages are down. Health insurance coverage is down. pension coverage is down, healthcare costs are up, bankruptcy cases are up, long-term unemployment is up. Those indicators, all education costs are up. So all these indicators that matter for the vast majority of people are on the downward trend or are not painting a very good picture. The things that are good are the things that matter for very, very few people. In particular, profits are up and CEO pay is booming.
Yeah, I was going to comment on that. Go ahead, please expand
and
on that.
I think that really, we call it the upside-down economy. Like, yes, the economy is growing, but the benefits are not going to the vast majority of people. They're going just a very, very select few through profit creation, stock options, stock grants. CEOs are doing well. By our calculations, the average CEO was paid 240 times what an average worker was paid in 2004.
And if I remember correctly, I've recently seen a statistic that said in the last year it's increased by 14.5% salaries or not exactly sure compensation figures for CEOs compared to less than 2 or 1% for the average worker.
For the average worker, the total wage has actually declined after inflation.
After inflation, right. I was giving it before inflation.
Which means like benefits. Uh-huh. It's a little bit above zero. The average CEO has made out like a bandit, probably in the order of magnitude to 13-14% last year, in just 1 year. Just to give you a sense of where this is concentrated, a lot of oil executives, so big raises for the CEOs in oil and gas companies. Their compensation rose by 109% last year. They're now the highest paid CEOs with $16 million. That's their average take-home pay for 2004. And so clearly there are some people who are doing really well in this economy, but the vast majority is not.
Let me just interrupt for a second and announce the phone number. You can give us a call at 412-268-9728. We're talking to Christian Weller of the Center for American Progress about economic issues and the problems of the current economy. When I was a boy, or maybe a college student or something, there was a great optimism in the world. I mean, maybe I was being a technologist and feeling the advances of technology would only help the country. The life would always get better. Things were always getting better. That was the trend. That's the way things should be going. But what we're seeing now is that things are getting worse, if I'm reading what you're saying correctly. The average person, their life is getting worse in this country significantly.
Well, the economic risks for people are getting larger, and people are struggling more. I mean, I think for me the clearest indicator is really what's happened in the bankruptcy side. I mean, we have seen record increases in bankruptcy rates. Bankruptcy rates now are at the highest levels they have ever been, despite the fact that the economy has been growing for 3 years. So it's a distributional problem. The economy is growing. We're expanding. The pie is growing, but we're not sharing the pie in an equitable manner, where we're giving most of the benefits or all of the benefits just to very, very few people who already have a lot of money. So it's more a question of how we make that more equitable. How do we let everybody share in the growth of the economy?
So
if we do that, and mm-hmm. which means like the average person would actually see the typical family would see higher incomes and better benefits. It would also mean that they would have to borrow less money on their credit cards, on the home equity lines, on the mortgages. It would actually reduce the economic struggle that many families face.
So when you refer to the high bankruptcy rates, you're referring to personal bankruptcy, right? You're not referring
that
to companies,
yes.
Right? And so I wonder if you have at hand statistics about the causes of personal bankruptcy. What is the trend here? What's happening? What we often hear on right-wing radio is it's basically a bunch of deadbeat losers who are trying to stiff credit card companies, the poor credit card companies, for their money. I wonder if there are any facts that can be brought to bear on what's really going on here.
Well, I mean, you're broadcasting from a university campus. I imagine
yep.
there's a lot of people listening who have debt experience going into debt for grad school or for college. So they know that this is not something they took on lightly. And I think that the claim that most people who go into bankruptcy because they were overburdened by debt and irresponsibly so doesn't ring true. By and large, the big reasons why people go into bankruptcy is medical emergencies and skyrocketing healthcare costs. The other one is unemployment, long spells of unemployment, and then the gap between low income growth and rapid debt accumulation, particularly credit card bills. Those are the big ones. And most people who go into bankruptcy and have big credit card bills don't have that because they went shopping at Best Buy or something like that. They really have the debt because of medical emergency. So it's ultimately the medical costs and the health insurance, the unemployment that cause unemployment. We put out a paper about 2 months ago where we looked at bankruptcy rates in all 50 states, and the trend is very clear that the three factors you find is low income growth, unemployment, and lack of health insurance are the three important pieces. And people have become, like, the bankruptcy rates have become more sensitive.
So there's less
of a safety net in the world. So, like, when people lose their health insurance, they go quicker into bankruptcy than they used to, and that has to do with the fact that income growth has been so meager the last few years.
And you mentioned that there's the threat of rising interest rates, which I think can only make matters worse. But considering even just the issue of credit card debt and the outrageous rates that are charged for people who have credit card debt, in response to this crisis in bankruptcy, the Congress has recently passed, and as far as I'm aware, Bush has not yet signed but intends to sign a new bankruptcy bill. I wondered if you could comment on that and how that's addressing the problems of the average person who is facing a debt crisis.
Well, if you're struggling and you're thinking about bankruptcy, the bill will make your life a little harder. The point of the bill is to let the credit card companies get as much of possible money that people have and not really give people the chance at a new start. If you look at what's happening on the bankruptcy side, the real problem is that people don't declare bankruptcy just because they want to. It's not something, a sign of irresponsibility. It's something that they have to because they have had emergencies. They lost their jobs. They had a chronic illness. They had a medical emergency. And those things force people into bankruptcy. And then the bankruptcy law is designed to give people the chance at a fresh start. Say, like, this happened to you due to no fault of your own, and we really want to give you the chance at a fresh start.
Mm-hmm.
And the bankruptcy bill, the new bankruptcy bill, would make it harder. Right now it's called Chapter 7. You go into Chapter 7, you wipe the slate clean. The new bill would make it harder to go into Chapter 7. It would make it, you would have to go into Chapter 13, which would basically require you to make some payments regardless of how hard it is. It would make it harder for you to really
to wipe the slate clean.
Start over again. Let me also say, like, the bankruptcy bill, and I'm not sure whether the final version had that, but originally the bankruptcy bill had a provision in there that if you had a trust set up, that trust was protected from the bankruptcy proceeding.
Yeah, could you explain that a bit further, please, for our listeners?
So if you set up a personal trust and you manage to put money away in that trust, the credit card companies couldn't get to it. So if you had a few million and you were able to set up a personal trust because you could afford it, because you had the right lawyers, you actually had assets protected. But if you only had a few $1,000 and you couldn't find the lawyers and you couldn't set up a trust, that money was no longer yours. I mean, the creditors, and particularly credit card companies, would ultimately be able to get the money.
Yeah, I'd like to really underline that point. I mean, there's a specific possibility now for the wealthy to shelter their personal assets, even things like their car or their cash, any of their personal assets, in a personal trust, so that it is exempted or is shielded from any kind of bankruptcy proceeding that may happen. I mean, it's quite incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I would not be beneficiaries of this.
I just have a general comment or question about how before I do that, let me mention the phone number. Give us a call at 412-268-9728. We're talking to Christian Weller, who's an economist with the Center for American Progress. Just a general comment about how this kind of legislation, and this isn't the only example, the tax cuts for the rich, the elimination of the estate tax, that one in particular is just, to me, just incredible that somehow they could ram this through in a popular and still be considered a popular bill. I mean, why haven't there been protests? Why haven't they been storming the Congress for? I mean, it's an amazing coup that they've managed to do something so completely against the people, and yet there's been no outcry against it.
I think there's, on the bankruptcy bill, I think there's two things happening here. Part of it is that people think it won't happen to them. So there's this hope that, well, I'm middle class, this can't happen to me.
That's,
you got to remember,
good point.
Right now, families have a higher chance, a substantially higher chance, to go through bankruptcy than to actually experience a divorce, for instance. And people think typically divorce is
pretty that really
prevalent.
True?
Oh, they have a higher chance of bankruptcy now.
Substantially higher.
Wow.
It's a 50% difference, not percentage point, but
that's incredible.
Difference. So it's substantially higher. So people don't really understand how severe the problem is. The other part is also, I think, and we see this with many other things when it comes to conservative policies, there's usually a communications machinery that precedes the policy actions, meaning there is a talk about framing the issue in a way that ultimately makes it easy to push the policy through. In this case, you portray everybody who goes into bankruptcy as an irresponsible scoundrel. And that way,
right,
there won't be any protests, because now people have to go out and actually dig up the data and say, like, no, that's not the case, and we have to do the research. We've known this for years, but the conservative machinery on this side has been very successful, to the degree that you find many progressive members of Congress voting for this bankruptcy bill, saying, like, well, but most people who declare bankruptcy are irresponsible, and this is a bill to hold them responsible. And I'm all for individual responsibility where it's warranted, but I think in this case the data is very clear. The vast majority of people declaring bankruptcy do so out of an emergency and out of necessity, not just because they want to abuse the system.
Well, it's strange that you mentioned that people don't think they're going to go into bankruptcy, because if you look at the reverse, elimination of the estate tax, that was apparently sold by somehow convincing people that you were going to be subjected to this terrible tax if you got rich, and somehow people thought that they were going to need that, which was, of course, completely preposterous. And the percentage of people who are affected by that is minuscule, but the amount of money is tremendous.
Well, the American dream is alive and well, at least in rhetoric, not in reality. And you got to remember, with the estate tax, there is an exemption already on the books for $1.5 million. So, like, if you stand to inherit $1.5 million, you can do so tax-free. There's only taxes above that that is increasing, and people have said, like, let's raise that. But just to be clear, only 1.25% of people even are affected pay an estate tax, people who inherit. So the vast majority of people are not affected by the estate tax. Most estates are vastly smaller than the $1.5 million exemption. But it is the same thing. People don't think that bankruptcy will hurt them, and people think they will be millionaires over the career of their career.
Yeah, they're
optimistic. And that will affect them.
Yeah.
Regardless of, for instance, the fact that income mobility, upper mobility, has slowed substantially over the last few decades.
And how much will the repeal? It seems to me that the Congress is certainly intends to repeal the estate tax. It's coming up for reconsideration, I think, this year. How much is that going to cost the economy? I mean, it's not merely a matter of
a few dozen people being affected,
right?
Let me just as background, right now there's $1.5 million exemption on the estate tax.
Right.
It's going up, I believe, to $3.5 million by 2009, and in 2010 it would be phased out. And the idea is then to completely eliminate it. For the next 10 years, the cost would be $290 billion. It's a fairly small number for the fact that there is actually an estate tax until 2009. Over the next 20 years, it would cost the government $2 trillion. So that's against the background of massive deficits the government already has. You're adding another $2 trillion over the next 20 years, and you're doing it just to favor less than 1% of people.